the Yugoslavian partisans to wipe them off the face of the earth. The Yugoslavian partisans were very, very much bloodied. They did manage to escape and later rebuilt, but the atrocities, when the flap broke about Kurt Waldheim, that conference at the Podgorica airstrip in May of 1943 with the head of, among others, of the Prinz Eugen Division was in preparation for Operation Schwarz. And for people who want to learn more about that region, get a hold of the Milovan Gilas book, Wartime, and you'll read about what that was like from the people who were on the receiving end of Kurt Waldheim's beneficence. At one point, for example, the partisans, the little group of partisans that Gilas was with, were hiding underneath the lip, an overgrown lip of a stream or riverbed, and all around them they could hear members of the Prinz Eugen Division combing the woods, executing people, and they had to make a run along this riverbed, and a lot of them were too badly wounded to travel, and they couldn't leave the wounded because they would be found by the SS and tortured for information. So several of them had to murder their own wounded, and one guy in particular who became something of a legend, sort of a living saint in post-war Yugoslavia, had to cut his own wife's throat. It had to be done quietly because they couldn't make any noise because the SS were all around them. Just imagine having to slit your own wife's throat to avoid having her fall into the hands of the SS. It's not the sort of thing one has to do, one wants to do. But when people who were inclined to downplay the seriousness of what Kurt Waldheim did, he was basically one of the authors of what Milovan Gilas and company were on the receiving end of. And it's not to be taken lightly. By the way, Kurt Waldheim got his first job with the post-World War II Austrian government, courtesy of a guy named Fritz Molden, who was a member of the Office of Strategic Services, and he also was Alan Dulles' son-in-law. Alan Dulles, a prominent American fascist of long standing, working with the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, later with the OSS, later the CIA, right on up through his stint as a Warren Commission member. Very, very interesting fellow, and I don't think it's any accident that an SOB like Kurt Waldheim was able to ride on the curt tails of Alan Dulles's, shirt tails of Alan Dulles's son-in-law into a position of primacy in the World War II government, which actually, in a way, is sort of a nice bridge to the immediate post-war history of Yugoslavia. The fascist groups that had been evident in Yugoslavia and held sway during World War II did not disappear. Again, it's worth bearing in mind that, among other institutions, the Catholic Church was extremely supportive of the Ustashi fascists in Croatia. Again, Archbishop Stepanak actually was a seated member of the Sabor, the Croatian parliament. Along with outfits like the Reinhard Galen Nazi spy outfit, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and other Central and Eastern European fascist emigre groups, the Croatian Ustashi relocated many of them to Germany, some of the more notorious to Latin America, because they had to flee war crimes trials. As I mentioned, a Croatian priest, Father Draganovic, was one of the central elements in the rat line, the combined U.S. intelligence-Vatican escape route for many of the most notorious Nazi war criminals. He worked in that regard with an Austrian Archbishop Alois Hudal, last name H-U-D-A-L. The Ustashi, unfortunately, did not disappear by any means. Many of them moved to Germany, where they were sponsored by the government of the Federal Republic as part of the XPLA ministers, groups from Eastern Europe that had been expelled by the Soviet armies, were harbored by the German government. There was actually a German government ministry called the Ministry for XPLA. The Croatian Ustashi basically maintained themselves intact as a political organization. Many of them fled to Germany. Many of them fled to Latin America. A great many of them fled to the United States. Andrija Artukovic, for example, the interior minister known as the Himmler of the Balkans, settled in Seal Beach, California, became a very prominent member of the citizen there, and when the Yugoslav government requested extradition to stand trial for war crimes, a Department of Immigration and Naturalization Services hearing was held, and they found that, in fact, there was no reason to extradite Andrija Artukovic because he was a wonderful guy and hadn't engaged in any sort of excesses. Turns out that all the character witnesses at this hearing were all former Ustashi who had been brought into the country along with Artukovic and were basically working in conjunction with U.S. intelligence. California in particular has been a repository for elements of the Ustashi. One of the holidays or one of the festivals that they celebrate is the April 10th holiday, which is an Ustashi holiday, and you'll find a lot of Croatian Americans celebrate that. It is a celebration of the anniversary of the German invasion of Yugoslavia in World War II, which took place on April 10th. The Croatian and Croatian-American communities celebrate that as a holiday. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, actually proclaimed April 10th Croatian-American Day because he'd been led by his political cronies. It took some people to clue him in that this was not a particularly adept thing, because basically this was a celebration of the German invasion of Yugoslavia in World War II, and even Reagan managed to understand that, so he eventually... He deep-sixed that, and I'm sure he had something appropriate to say. Well, gee, I didn't know that. Nancy never told me about that, and I don't know what this Ustashi is, and it's kind of like a Watusi, or maybe it's more like a jacuzzi, but anyway, you know, win one for the Gipper. Speaking, by the way, of Ronald Reagan, he was not at all separate from these events. One of the, this is something I've spoken about before, but one of the many programs that brought these kinds of people into the United States, and their stewardship by the United States is not irrelevant here, because it's going to lead directly to the destabilization of Yugoslavia in the 1980s and 1990s, and we're going to get to that in a second. But among the many programs that brought these SOBs here was something most inappropriately called the Crusade for Freedom. The Crusade for Freedom was an illegal domestic intelligence operation by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of Policy Coordination. To make a long story short, in 1948, the Republicans blamed the defeat of Thomas Dewey on the Jews, the large number of Jews in this area. And so to counteract that, what they felt was needed was to mobilize the large Eastern European ethnic voting blocs, in particular in the so-called Rust Belt, the large American cities of the industrial Midwest and Northeast, on behalf of political reaction. So they began bringing in Croatian Ustashi, Bulgarian National Front members, veterans of the fascist government of Lithuania, Ukrainian Waffen-SS veterans, people associated with the OUNB, Romanian Iron Guardists, Hungarian Arrow Cross veterans, many of them war criminals of the First Order, some of them veterans of the Eastern Front, some of them Waffen-SS veterans, and they were brought into the United States. And again, this is completely illegal. And they were set up as ethnic leaders in many of the Eastern European ethnic communities in many of the large American industrial cities of the Midwest and Northeast. Polish reactionaries were brought in as well. Now, the guy who basically conceived of the Crusade for Freedom, again, a most inappropriate name, was the aforementioned Alan Dulles, the same guy whose son-in-law, Fritz Molden, got Kurt Waldheim his first job with the post-World War II Austrian government. The guy who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom for Alan Dulles was his protege, Richard Nixon, a name that may ring a bell for some people. The guy who was the chief front man for the Crusade for Freedom was Ronald Reagan. And the guy who handled the State Department machinations to bring these guys into the United States, which was completely illegal, was William Casey. And again, this is not something which is irrelevant to the discussion, because we're to see those same elements, namely under Ronald Reagan, we were to see William Casey, his campaign manager and a member of the Knights of Malta, by the way, remember that, became director of the CIA. And his vice president, Reagan's vice president, was George Bush. Again, another former director of Central Intelligence. George Bush was a political protege of Richard Nixon, among others. Prescott Nixon was a good buddy. That's, by the way, that's George. Prescott Bush, rather, was a good buddy of Richard Nixon's, and also a good buddy of William Casey's as well. Now, these elements, basically the fascist elements that fled World War II Yugoslavia, found succor, so to speak, that's S-U-C-C-O-R, in the United States, basically at the bosom of the U.S. National Security Establishment, and also in Germany at the bosom of the German National Security Establishment, the two being very, very closely connected. And again, bear in mind some of these relationships, because they were to come back in a big, big way. We should also understand, too, that as we look at the historical development to what is taking place now, that in post-war Yugoslavia, Tito, in order to basically try to maintain the integrity of the Yugoslav Federation, one of the things that he did was to grant Kosovo autonomous status. And when you hear all this stuff about the Kosovars saying, well, we want to be free, we want this, we want that, in 1974, Tito granted the Kosovars autonomous status. Although they were still part of Yugoslavia, they had functional autonomy and could basically select their own police, political figures, educational figures as well. They had their own medical community, their own educational community. This is worth understanding, because the Kosovars used their independence to oppress the Serbian minority in Kosovo because they wanted Kosovo to be joined to Albania as part of the greater ethnic Albania that had existed briefly under Nazi and Italian fascist stewardship during World War II. So this basically brings us up to the 1980s. And let me just check our time here and see how we're doing time-wise. Grant, do you know what our when do the coaches turn into pumpkins and the horses into mice tonight? Do you know? We've got eight. It's 8:38 now. I just want to try to gauge the luck. I also want to have time for questions from the audience. What I'm wondering is can we go up to 11? Because that'll give us plenty of time for a long break and time for questions. Yeah, we could probably do it. Yep, we can probably do it. Okay. What we're doing is we've come up to the 1980s. How many of you would like to take a break now, or how many would like to take a break a little later? Okay, we're gonna keep going here, because again, I'm a major league talker, and sometimes I'm afraid I talk too much and I exhaust the patience of the audience, and that I don't want to do that this time. Plus, we got plenty of time, and this is not a monstrously huge venue, so we can be informal about it. Basically, again, it's worth understanding that the political forces that existed and held sway in Yugoslavia during World War II did not disappear with the military defeat of Hitler's forces in that war, but rather found a very nurturing environment in the political forces in the United States and Germany that had supported fascism in the first place and that had seen Mussolini and Hitler as saviors of a sort. In the 1980s, basically, with the coming to power of Ronald Reagan, we saw a liberation government in effect. What we basically saw was a Third Reich covert action and political warfare strategy, which entailed utilizing the various ethnic nationalities, not only of the Balkans, but also of the former Soviet Union, as political allies, and the political strategy that the Nazis engaged in was to grant these groups their nominal independence as satellite states of Nazi Germany, and then to utilize them to break up the not only Yugoslavia, but the former Soviet Union, when those countries then became, or were to become, satellite states of Nazi Germany. This rollback or liberation theory was adopted by the United States at the end of World War II and became the dominant Cold War strategy employed by the United States. And basically, it was a Third Reich political warfare and covert action strategy adopted by the United States and given superficial democratic credentials. Ronald Reagan came to power, and there are a number of national security directives of the Reagan administration applying to Yugoslavia. As far as I know, most of them have not been declassified. What appears to have been the strategy, though, from the little bit we have been able to determine about the actual documents, was to use America's economic might, and bear in mind that many of these same political forces still existed within the bosom of the American and German political and national security establishments, was to utilize American economic might by channeling aid to the various ethnic groups within Yugoslavia. Now, I should jump back a little bit about what had happened in this time. Yugoslavia, although communist, had broken earlier, became the first of those countries to move away from the former Soviet Union. And, in fact, Tito broke with Stalin in 1948. It was actually the threat at one point of war between Soviet Russia and Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was the closest of any of the Eastern European communist countries to the West and traded quite freely with the West. It even was at one point getting some weapon systems from the West. Because Yugoslavia was the closest to the West of any of the Eastern European countries, when many of the Western nations, in particular Western European nations, experienced an economic slowdown in the late 70s and early 80s, this had a significant effect on Yugoslavia as well, and it left Yugoslavia in dire economic straits. When people become poor, it tends to bring out the worst in them, and usually they start looking around for somebody to blame and something to do. And if you want to destabilize a group of people, impoverish them first, and they will be ripe for the destabilization. Tito himself died in 1980. It's worth bearing in mind that many of the groups that are now at each other's throats viewed Tito as something of a savior. The Kosovars, for example, bearing in mind that Tito, an ethnic Croat himself, was very mindful of the ethnic problems within the former Yugoslavia. Many of the Kosovars, prior to the recent episode of hostilities, when they were engaging in passive political resistance to the Serbs, were actually marching in protests with Tito's picture, because they viewed Tito as something of a model for how to administer things politically in their neck of the woods. Tito died in 1980, and his successor died 2 years later. I wonder about the death of his successor. There's no way of knowing for sure, but I suspect that that death may very well have been a hit, because the Yugoslav Federation was targeted for disintegration. It's also worth bearing in mind that that's a very economically rich part of the world. It turns out that Albania has a lot of oil. The most valuable piece of economic real estate in all of the Balkans just happens to be in, surprise, surprise, Kosovo. Excuse me. Kosovo has a huge mining complex, the Trepka mines, which are the most valuable piece of economic real estate in the Balkans. The Trepka mines supplied the Third Reich with 40% of their lead in World War II, and that's only one of the minerals that comes out of Trepka. The ores that are mined there are extremely rich, and it makes it a very, very prized piece of economic real estate. Think about, again, in World War II, the Nazis got 40%, the Third Reich got 40% of its lead from the Trepka mines. Think about the batteries, for example, for all those planes, trains, ships, tanks, motor vehicles, not to mention all those bullets. That's a lot of lead. And 40% of their entire lead came, all their lead came from the Trepka mines. It is the most valuable piece of economic real estate in the Balkans. So in terms of understanding the Serbs' attitude towards Kosovo, it's important to understand not only the historical background and the ethnic resentments, which again go back, first of all, to the Ottoman Empire, when the Serbs were second-class citizens and when the Muslim nationalities of the Balkans enjoyed a relatively privileged status, and then again in World War II, when the ethnic Albanians and the Kosovars sided with the Axis and participated in the slaughter of the Serbs in World War II. A combination of the historical memory and the fact that Kosovo had the most valuable piece of economic real estate in all of Serbia or all of the Balkans has had much to do with shaping the attitude on the part of the Serbian government. Just think, for example, if a foreign power wanted to annex, say, California and Texas and some of the other economically rich areas of the United States, and if they had the backing of an enormous military power greater than the United States, say if they began fomenting Mexican nationalism along the American Southwest, and Texas, California, Arizona, and New Mexico were part of Mexico until the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and after the Mexican War. And suppose all of the Mexicans in these areas began lobbying for autonomy. Suppose they were then given autonomy. Again, to understand the way the Serbian people feel, I think extrapolating perhaps poorly to an American political reality might be useful under the circumstances. Well, suppose with the backing of this huge military power, the ethnic Mexicans in this huge area then began oppressing the white people in this area. And suppose when the white people reacted, and again, just imagine how, the average, redneck Californian would respond to that. What? Those Mexicans, they can't do that to me? Well, I'm an American. I've lived here for 50 years. Who do they think they are, Then, when the ethnic Mexicans began oppressing the white minority, then if this gigantic military backed them, and when we responded, began bombing us so that they could annex California, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, this would give you some idea of how the Serbian people view what has taken place there. Now, the evidence suggests, although most of the relevant documents are still classified, that Yugoslavia was targeted for a deliberate program of destabilization in the 1980s. It was a country that was ripe for destabilization. Its ethnic makeup, I hope I've done a little bit to give you an idea, of its ethnic makeup. It was poor, and again, because of the fact that it was the closest to the West of any of the communist nations, when Western Europe and much of the rest of the West experienced a downturn in the 70s and then the early 80s, this had a very significant effect in Yugoslavia, and the poorer people are, the more easily they are turned in any particular direction. In 1987, a member of the Yugoslav military, a Croatian officer named Franjo Tudjman, spelled T-U-D-J-M-A-N, is believed to have visited Germany by Western intelligence services, and there he conferred with Helmut Kohl. Franjo Tudjman later was to become the head of, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia, when Croatia and Slovenia were to secede from the Yugoslav Federation. The evidence suggests that Franjo Tudjman and Helmut Kohl, bear in mind that the Croatian Ustashi were sponsored to a large extent under the auspices of the German Expelle Ministry, they were in all likelihood discussing the coming destabilization and partitioning of Yugoslavia. It's worth bearing in mind that when Croatia and Slovenia declared their independence from the Yugoslav Federation, which they did in 1990, actually, maybe somebody correct, I believe it was 1990 they first declared. 1991 was when they actually, their independence was recognized. But we believe they actually declared in 1990. It's worth understanding that in all likelihood, this was the product of destabilization. It's also worth noting that as the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo began to agitate further for the annexation of Kosovo to Albania, something, by the way, that was supported by the Albanian government of Enver Hoxha. It's worth understanding that ideology is only one part of a political struggle. Enver Hoxha was the Stalinist dictator of Albania, but he was an Albanian chauvinist, and he actively supported the independence aspirations of the Kosovars. In 1989... as a result of agitation and beyond that, sporadic violence by the Kosovars against the Serbian minority living there, Slobodan Milosevic was able to rise to power within the Yugoslavian Communist Party, largely by promising a return to the policies of the strong hand. Violence was already in evidence in Kosovo by 1987, and in 1989, in response to the Kosovar oppression of the Serbian minority, in Kosovo, this is important to remember because we're being told, you know, the Kosovars are these poor victims and this and that. They had autonomy. They were granted autonomy by Tito in 1974, but they began to oppress the Serbian minority. Slobodan Milosevic essentially rose within the Communist Party of Yugoslavia as a reactionary and promising basically to institute the policies of the strong hand in Kosovo. It was the oppression of the Serbian minority in Kosovo by the ethnic Albanian Muslim Kosovar majority that actually led to the elevation of Slobodan Milosevic within the Yugoslavian Communist Party. In 1989, he made a serious mistake, albeit an understandable one. He withdrew Kosovar autonomy. Basically, all of that was written off. And Kosovo, once again, it was brought under Serbian domination. It had been part of Yugoslavia nominally, but was functionally autonomous. In what was an understandable but very serious political error, Slobodan Milosevic basically withdrew that autonomy. But we're hearing all about, you know, what a monster Slobodan Milosevic is and comparing him to Hitler, which is ridiculous. But bear in mind that his actual accession to power was a direct result of the Kosovar ethnic Albanian oppression of the Serbian minority and the altogether understandable Serbian distaste at that particular action. Had it not been for that, it's unlikely that Slobodan Milosevic would have risen within the Yugoslavian Communist Party. This is important to remember. The evidence suggests that one of the major elements in the destabilization of the Yugoslav Federation was not only the increased agitation or increasing the agitation on behalf of the various ethnic groups there, but also the financing of the independence aspirations of some of those groups. In particular, a very important, albeit largely unknown, aspect of the dissolution of Yugoslavia concerns a $2 billion interest-free loan that was made to Croatia by the American branch of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Now, the Knights of Malta is a lay order within the Vatican dating back to the Crusades that could, in effect, be thought of as the military branch of the Vatican. The full name of that group is the Knights of the Sovereign Military Order of St. John of Jerusalem. Generally reduced to the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or SMOM. The Knights of Malta is comprised of key political and military figures who are believed to have done a great deal to have furthered the cause of Roman Catholicism around the world. In particular, very many key American intelligence and military officials are members of the Knights of Malta. Some of the American branch of the Knights of Malta include William Casey, Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and director of the CIA in this critical period of time. Alexander Haig, Reagan's first Secretary of State, is a Knight of Malta. William Wilson, his first ambassador to the Vatican, is a Knight of Malta. William F. Buckley, the former CIA officer, perhaps former belongs in quotes, and a noted political columnist, is a Knight of Malta. So is his brother James, a former senator from the state of New York. William Simon, former Secretary of the Treasury, is a Knight of Malta. Half the members of the P2 Lodge were Knights of Malta. The Knights of Malta awarded Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi Eastern Front spy chief, its Gran Crocito al Merito. It was something like the seventh or eighth man in the history of the entire order to get that, and that order goes back to the Crusades. give you an idea of how much they valued Reinhard Galen. His brother was very much involved with the Knights. Galen's brother, that is, was very much involved with the Knights of Malta. And together with some of the other Vatican Knight orders, they wielded a profound influence within the American and other countries' national security establishments. William Donovan, for example, was a Vatican Knight. I believe he was a Knight of the Order of St. Sylvester. It's a different order, but very similar. Vernon Walters, former deputy director of the CIA and a roaming ambassador at large for Ronald Reagan, was another member of another of the Vatican Knight orders. The point is that these are not very well recognized, but they are tremendously influential. And the American branch of the Knights of Malta arranged for a $2 billion interest-free loan to be given to Croatia when Croatia was still part of Yugoslavia. This money had a lot to do with financing the various activities of Croatian independence. Again, bear in mind that Franjo Tuđman appears to have tried, his trip to Italy, or trip to Germany rather, was almost certainly to confer with Helmut Kohl about how to destabilize Yugoslavia and how to arrange the effecting of Croatian independence. When the wall came down, when the Soviet Union collapsed, obviously things began to open up in Eastern Europe. And it's worth noting that the ethnic centripetal forces in Yugoslavia peaked when Croatia and Slovenia declared their independence from the Yugoslavian Federation. This, from a political standpoint, is not unlike the Confederate States of the United States declaring their independence. These were member states of Yugoslavia. They declared their independence. It's also worth understanding not only the fact that Croatia was the same Roman Catholic Croatia that affected the horrors that I've already described during World War II, but that Croatia and Slovenia were both relatively wealthy regions in Yugoslavia. Both, remember, had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and as such had not experienced the oppression that and the suffering that other groups had experienced in World War I. By switching sides, by becoming part of Yugoslavia, Croatia and Slovenia got out of having to pay the reparations that the defeated nations of World War I did. So that when Croatia and Slovenia declared their independence, it is rather like the wealthy parts of a city, the wealthy suburbs, declaring their independence from a state. It also engendered a tremendous amount of resistance simply from an economic standpoint, because basically this was taking two of the richest areas of Yugoslavia out. And these are people who had enjoyed a relatively privileged status. So in terms of understanding how this affected the Serbs in terms of their political outlook, again, these were two wealthy areas that had really made out pretty nicely as a result of the history of the 20th century. They got to enjoy the largesse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then switched sides at the end of World War I, escaped the reparations payments, enjoyed a relatively privileged status under the Yugoslavian monarchy, and so they were still quite wealthy. Croatia, of course, then became the brutal fascist state in World War II with the horrors that I've described. Slovenia also has very, very strong German historical influence. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I think seven of the first eight Slovenian cabinet ministers in the, quote, new, unquote, Slovenia were German. And again, German geopolitics here is very, very important to understand. Initially, the European Union voted basically to keep Yugoslavia intact. Now, the first vote that was taken place was 11-1. Basically, the Europeans understood the history of this region, and they understood the simmering ethnic tensions in that part of the world. They also understood that World War I began in that part of the world, and they understood the historical probability and the political probability that if in fact Yugoslavia was dissolved, if the Yugoslav Federation was dissolved, that this would lead to a resumption of the hostilities that had plagued that region for 500 years and which had most recently flared up with the effect of great bloodletting during the Second World War. The EU voted 11-1 to maintain the integrity of the Yugoslav Federation on the initial vote. The one vote voting to recognize Croatian and Slovenian independence was, surprise, surprise, Germany. Gradually, at the Maastricht, the drawing up of the Maastricht Treaty, Germany basically attached the integrity of the European Union to the dissolution of Yugoslavia. And basically, Germany twisted arms politically and diplomatically. until finally, in order to get the go-ahead for the European Union and for the Maastricht Treaty, the European Union had to vote to recognize the independence of Slovenia and Croatia. This was a German show, basically. They twisted arms, and gradually the vote metamorphosed. The initial vote, again, was 11-1 against dissolving the Yugoslav Federation, the one vote being Germany. But Germany dominates Europe, and Germany twisted arms until finally Croatian and Slovenian independence became recognized. It's worth noting that the first two recognitions, diplomatic recognitions of Slovenian and Croatian independence, were by Germany and, surprise, surprise, the Vatican. Bear in mind, the Vatican is actually a separate state and has been since the Lateran Treaty of 1929. Unfortunately, the history of that region that had obtained during World War II appears to have been recapitulated to a striking extent. It's worth noting that when Croatia became independent, and when Franjo Tuđman, the same military officer who had basically traveled to Germany in 87 to confer with Helmut Kohl, to make a long story short, what happened was a recapitulation of the fascist Ustaše collaborationist regime of World War II to an enormous extent. In the first place, the national anthem, the flag, the currency, two of the same officials from the Ustaše regime, and all of the policies were reinstituted. Now, just imagine, again, and I want to stress I don't sanction ethnic cleansing or atrocity by anybody, but just imagine how this looked to the Serbs who had been on the receiving end of some of the horrors that I've described. Basically, they were seeing a fellow Franjo Tuđman, who was an unapologetic Croatian nationalist, a Holocaust denier, by the way. He comes to power, declares an independent Croatia, which has something that had great horrors for the Serbian people, then brings back the currency, the national anthem, the flag, two of the same officials from the fascist period. Beyond that, no sooner did Croatia become, quote, independent, unquote, than Serbs were kicked out of government jobs, Serb media voices were closed, Serbs were kicked out of the media, a special tax was imposed on Serbs that was not applied to other members of the other ethnic minorities in Croatia, and Serbs were required to carry an identity card in which the middle number was an 8, or maybe it was, no, I guess the 8th figure was the number 3. In any event, this identity card that Serbs were forced to carry identified every Serb, so that a Croatian policeman or soldier could identify a Serb simply by checking their ID card. To the Serbs in Croatia, basically, this said to them, look out, here it comes again. And that turned out to be a very realistic appraisal. One of the things that Germany did was to take the arms that had been abandoned by East Germany, by the East German military, when the wall came down and after German reunification. These were, of course, East Bloc arms from the former Soviet Union. Most of the arms used by the former Yugoslavian army were East Bloc arms. And so the Croatian military was able to train with this weaponry very, very effectively. It's also worth noting, too, that as Yugoslavia dissolved, one of the factors that contributed to that was that disproportionate numbers of the Yugoslavian military were Croatian. In fact, to a large extent, the officer corps of the former Yugoslavian army was composed of Croatians. When I earlier ruminated about what might take place in the United States in the next century, bear in mind that most of the officers in our military are white southern males, and they see things in a very, very different fashion from most Americans, and that I would not dismiss the possibility of a repeat of the tragedy of Yugoslavia in the United States in the next century. But it's worth understanding that one of the things that bedeviled the Yugoslavian Federation as it attempted to maintain its political and territorial integrity was that a disproportionate percentage of the Yugoslavian officer corps were Croatian, including Franjo Tuđman. Now, again, the military and the police in Croatia were armed with weapons that had been channeled to them by Germany, in violation of international law, by the way. And it's worth noting that, and as I mentioned, every Serb was required to carry an ID card identifying him or her as a Serb. And this basically, as I said before, this said to the Serbs in Croatia, look out, it's coming again. And indeed, they were quite right. The Yugoslavian or the Croatian police and military once again engaged in a brutal program of ethnic cleansing. Germany and the Vatican were able to do a couple of things. They not only prevailed on it, it didn't take a lot of arm twisting, I'm sure, for George Bush to go along with his German allies and recognize Slovenian and Croatian independence. It's worth noting, though, that Bush was essentially going along with the German program. The United States brought the rest of the West into line with regard to recognizing the dissolution of the Yugoslavian Federation. And no sooner did Croatia become armed and politically cohesive than once again the Croatian military and police went out into the countryside to begin the ethnic cleansing of Serbs. And before they did so, they were reviewed in an athletic stadium by Franjo Tuđman personally and once again received the blessing of the Catholic clergy in Croatia prior to going out and conducting ethnic cleansing. 1991 alone, 250,000 Serbs were ethnically cleansed in what used to be Yugoslavia. In 1991 alone, yet we didn't hear anything about that. And that's why I earlier mentioned the analogy of an American football game where in a pileup, one guy basically, you know, pokes a guy in the eye or, you know, kicks him in a tender spot, and then the other guy retaliates, and the ref only sees the retaliation, so he penalizes them for unsportsmanlike conduct because he didn't see the first blow. It's very, very similar to that. We're told, isn't that horrible what all of those Serbs are doing? Isn't that awful? But what we're not told is what was done to them to provoke that. When, finally, the Yugoslavian National Army began to respond to this ethnic cleansing on the part of the Croats. Basically, they were condemned as aggressors, and specifically, some 5,000 Serbs were trapped in the city of Vukovar, and they were going to be exterminated. The Yugoslavian army came in to try to save these people from death. This was labeled an act of aggression. International sanctions were imposed on the Serbs, and they were labeled aggressors. Something rather similar to that happened in Bosnia as well. Now, I'm telescoping some of this in the interests of time. Bosnia also declared its independence from the Yugoslav Federation, and once again recognition was provided by the West. It's worth understanding that Alija Izetbegović, again, the president of Bosnia, had, of course, been a member of the Hanjar division as a young man. He served, and he was also a recruiter for the Hanjar division. He served a brief 3-year prison sentence for that. The Yugoslavs were relatively benign in the way they treated some of the more minor war criminals because, again, the ethnocentric nature of the Yugoslav Federation made it difficult to punish some of those past a point because it would simply engender more resentment. Alija Izetbegović eventually was freed from prison. In 1970, he penned something called the Islamic Declaration. This basically was his political manifesto, and it's worth understanding that Alija Izetbegović is, in addition to the other things that he is, and I'm going to talk about those, is a doctrinaire Islamic fundamentalist. In the Islamic Declaration of 1970, he states that in no uncertain terms, which is that Islam is politically and religiously incompatible with other groups and other religions, and that in a country with a Muslim majority, it is imperative, and this is in his Islamic declaration, that they not cooperate with or grant self-rule to any of these other groups. It is stated in his political manifesto that Muslims should dominate other groups and use force when necessary to do so, and that for a Muslim, a secular state is completely out of the question. This, again, is worth understanding because in his political manifesto, Izetbegović states in no uncertain terms that the compatibility with other groups is not to be tolerated. So once again, a part of the Yugoslavian Federation breaks off and is once again recognized by the Western powers. Just imagine what things were like in Bosnia. If you were a Serb living in Bosnia, and all of a sudden this area that you've lived in becomes a nominally separate country, and the guy who becomes the president of this country basically has stated in his political manifesto that democracy and equal rights are not to be accorded to members of other groups. One could hardly blame the Serbs in Bosnia for being a little agitated about this fellow's return to power. It's also worth noting, too, that when the inevitable civil war took place in that in Bosnia, once again the Serbs were labeled as aggressors, which is simply not true. In the first place, when Alija Izetbegović became president of Bosnia, once again he got arms from Germany and from the international community, in spite of the fact that there was supposed to be an arms embargo on Bosnia. Even President Mubarak of Egypt advised the United States against violating the arms embargo there because he was aware of the Islamic fundamentalist nature of the Muslim government. Bear in mind, too, what took place in Yugoslavia during World War II with regard to the Muslim nationalities there. Again, they not only were temporarily, at least, quote, liberated, unquote, and the Nazis restored, and the other Axis occupiers of the Balkans restored some of the political realities that had obtained in that part of the world in order to maintain control. Kosovo was, which is primarily Muslim, was temporarily joined to Albania as part of a greater Albania. Divisions were recruited from among the ethnic nationalities. Bear in mind that Izetbegović was a member of the Hanjar division, a brutal Bosnian Muslim Waffen-SS division. And bear in mind also, another unit we're going to come back to is the Skanderberg division of ethnic Albanians from Kosovo. No sooner did Alija Izetbegović become president of Bosnia than one of the things that he did was to revive the Hanjar division. He recreated his unit from his youth, and it was specifically named after and patterned after the 13th Waffen-SS division. Now, again, think about what sort of effect this would have had on the Serbs living in Bosnia. Here you've got a guy who was with the Hanjar division as a young man. No sooner does he become president, and this is a guy who's an Islamic fundamentalist, and who has stated in no uncertain terms that there can be no compatibility between Islam and other religions, and no democracy or equal rights can be granted to other groups. And this guy was a member of the SS as a young man. No sooner does he become president than he revives the Hanjar division. He recreates his old unit, specifically named after and explicitly patterned after the 13th Waffen-SS division. The Hanjar division, interestingly enough, is composed primarily not of Bosnian Muslims, but of ethnic Albanians. It is trained primarily by Pakistani and Afghan veterans of the Afghan War. That was America's largest covert operation during the 1980s. It serves a number of different purposes. It serves as the palace guard for Alija Izetbegović and the other others of the Bosnian Muslim leadership. It also serves as kind of a special forces unit and is frequently deployed in conjunction with other Bosnian Muslim military units. And something we're going to come back to in a second, in the mid-1990s, it was engaged in force projection into Kosovo, Albania, and Macedonia. Again, bear in mind that most of the members of this newly created Waffen-SS division here in calendar year 1999 are ethnic Albanians, and that it serves as a special forces unit and as Alija Izetbegović's palace guard and the guard of the other Islamic leadership. So those are worth bearing in mind, too. Again, the long-term historical realities: for 500 years, the Serbs were second-class citizens in the Ottoman Empire. And it's worth bearing in mind the names of some of the people that came to power. Ali, the B-E-G in Izetbegović's name, and also the B-E-Y in his foreign minister's name, a guy named Mohammed Sasir Bey. That refers to the Beys, the B-E-Y-S, who were the aristocracy, the elite, if you will, of the Ottoman Empire.